welcome to our Euro 2024 preview show of House of Comments. Very excited. No, Emma?
I mean, technically it's before it. I'm not sure it's a preview of it.
Well, you don't know what I've got planned. I'm Charlotte Henry. She's a very sceptical Emma Bunnell. We're halfway through the campaign, aren't we now?
We are just over halfway. There is just under 3 weeks to go.
Cue Bon Jovi. We're here. We've had more debates than are in any way necessary. Can I tell you, I'm joking about the football. I was watching England decimate Oman at the cricket yesterday. I flicked over in between innings.
Now, if you want a game I understand even less than football,
it's cricket. Okay. But I flicked over in between innings to watch the seven-way debate. And I turned back off after about 5 minutes. It was atrocious. What is the point of this?
Format wise, it was slightly better than the first ITV one.
You mean the Starmer Sunak one?
No, I mean not the first ITV one, the first of the seven way and odds debates.
Yep.
Simply because they did do that thing of giving them all time to answer separately without interruption at first, which was better. But I just don't know. I mean, it's very, very hard for me to put myself into the mindset of someone who is both a low information voter, i.e. somebody who is not following politics anywhere near as much as I am, but who also decides to turn on for a debate of the people who aren't going to be prime minister.
For 90 minutes?
For 90 minutes. And think what they might have got out of that I found lacking. But I, even when trying to do that, I'm not entirely sure I get the point.
In the few minutes I watched, I saw Penny Mordaunt and Angela Rayner just talk over each other. I saw then Daisy Cooper, but Angela Rayner and Penny Mordaunt talk over each other. Mm-hmm. I saw the Green Lady be a bit smug and green about everything. I saw the Welsh guy, the Plaid Cymru guy, sort of lecture everyone, and then everyone talk over each other again.
I thought, and I know I, this is not my normal opinion of them. I thought Carla Denny did all right, actually. I think in terms of the voters that she's appealing to, she did pretty well.
Sure.
I thought that, the SNP guy, Stephen Flynn
yeah,
was really aggro.
Surely not.
And I know that's kind of his thing, but I just thought it came across very poorly. Now, whether or not, again, that's been focus groups with the kind of voters that he's appealing to and works, I don't know. The Welsh guy was just lost, and I'm not even going to pretend to know how to say his name. Other than that, the big Nigel Farage was Nigel Farage, yawn. And the big three were equally
talking over each other.
I mean, what was, in terms of like the campaign dynamics, what was obvious is that everyone felt the need to go after Labour rather than the Tories, because it's Labour who's going to win the election. There was a bit of the Tory record, but there was an awful lot more of a scrutiny on Labour, and you can see why.
Yeah, you certainly can. You mentioned Nigel Farage being Nigel Farage, which is obviously interesting, and his presence has caused ructions in the campaign. It's really thrown things open, which is really interesting, because Reform already in the campaign, and he's only running in one seat. It's not a presidential campaign where he can become prime minister. But we've now seen in one poll, just the YouGov poll, his Reform Party overtake the Conservatives. We have had the crossover moment. What was it, 19%, 18%, something like that?
It was. And I mean, it's a massive moment in some ways.
Is it?
Let me finish my sentence. You're like Penny Bloody Mordaunt, you are.
My hair's almost as big this morning.
Basically, it's within the margin of error. In numerical terms, it's not a massive moment. It could easily slip back the other way in the next poll, what have you. what it is another devastating blow to the morale of Tories and Tory activists. And they just, you know, the hits just keep on coming.
Yes. I entirely agree with you. It is an outlier poll. I think also it puts the Liberal Democrats on the verge of becoming the official opposition, which again, a bit of an outlier. We've seen them fairly consistently do okay in these polls, the same kind of numbers, but it's a bit of an outlier, this YouGov poll. Now, that does not mean it's wrong. YouGov may be finding something other people are not. We have to be very careful. But for the moment...
It's worth remembering in 2017, the YouGov MRP was the one that originally predicted what became the outcome.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. I had exactly the same thought when I saw this. It's very easy to dismiss these polls as an outlier. It doesn't mean they're the ones that are wrong.
I mean, I think the interesting question is what it does in terms of seats. Because while Nigel Farage might well win Clacton, I don't think Reform are going to get a second seat because, unlike the Lib Dems, their vote may be high, but it's highly dispersed. And they are almost entirely and quite openly running as spoilers to the Conservative Party.
You don't think Lee Anderson might be returned? We haven't seen him at all, but...
I mean, we talked about this previously. Mm. His polling's not great in Ashfield. There is the split between him and the Ashfield Independents, and Labour are near enough, as damn it, to 50% in a seat where there are six candidates.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suspect the reason we haven't seen him on TV, as you say, we did touch on this before, is because he's desperately trying to hold on to that seat. Which obviously swung from Gloria Di Piero to him, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. I've just logged in and that's changed a little bit. Ooh. Now. The Conservatives are down on 8%, but now...
Sorry,
Labour...
say that sentence again.
In Ashfield, Conservatives are on 8%. The random local party is on 12% and Labour and Reform are on 39% each, according to Electoral Calculus.
Very interesting. So...
So it does look like a straight fight. So maybe there will be a potential leadership contest for Reform. Although how you can have a leadership contest in a party that's just a company owned almost outright by Nigel Farage would be an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a funny thought, but I don't think that's what the story is here. I think the story is if they can get two of them, if they can get Farage and Lee Anderson into Parliament, that will be very interesting. I mean, the few minutes I watched, you can see why Nigel Farage works. He is, I mean, I disagree with basically every word that comes out of his mouth, but he's a fantastic political communicator.
He's a very good communicator of a very simplistic politics that is,
yes,
it's a false prospectus.
Yes.
And we're going to go on to talk about Europe, which, again, I think everyone's being overly simplistic about.
Yes.
But, yeah, of course, he's a huckster and hucksters, you know, make money for a reason. if this was 200, 150 years ago, he'd be selling you snake oil out of the back of a caravan. But as it is, he's selling you snake oil out of the front of a TV screen.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm just looking again at this poll. So it dropped Labour down 1 point to 37%. I don't think we're going to see total meltdown for that. The Lib Dems are down a single point, and as were the Greens. So look, I think there is an interesting story. You've touched on this at various points while we've been chatting about everyone talks about the Reform vote coming from the Conservatives. There's obviously bits that come from Labour as well that is worth watching.
There are bits and pieces, yeah. I think it's something like 3-1.
Sure.
Which means that in terms of seats, it won't have the same kind of impact at all. There's some green vote that slips to Labour, and that may well have an impact in two, possibly even three seats.
Yeah. I don't want to overstate the Reform to Labour thing, but it's not zero.
It's not zero. And if you look at the 2019 Labour to Tory pro-Brexit vote, that is there may be some people who just couldn't vote Tory then, but are thinking of voting Reform now.
Well, we better talk about it. You and I assiduously try and never talk about Brexit. The problem is our politicians trying to get elected and into Downing Street are not talking about Brexit either. Look, to some extent, right, I get it. It was a thing that happened 8 years ago.
Yeah.
The vote, it was implemented, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah.
Over 4 years ago, nearly 4.5 years ago. So I get why we might, in some people might say, look, it's happened, let's move on. But there's so much talk about the economy. There's so much talk about growth. Why is no one talking about that one of the causes of some of the problems in this country is Brexit? It's basically the unmentionable in this election campaign.
Well, the main reason is because you can't do anything about the past.
Do you think it's as simple as that?
I think it largely is as simple as that. And I think those people who just constantly go, but what about Brexit, are missing the point. Yes, there will be movement in terms of our relationship with Europe. But again, a lot of the people trying to sell this are doing so in far oversimplistic terms.
Sorry, trying to sell what?
For example, the Lib Dems saying we'll go back into the single market and customs union. Okay, under what terms?
Sure.
Because the problem is they've got a manifesto entirely based at a domestic audience without thinking, well, actually, think about a negotiation, which that would have to be between Britain and the EU, is that there are two sides on that. And we won't get anything like the kind of deal that we had. And as a result, I'm not entirely sure that either side's going to end up happy about what happens with that. The people who were pro Brexit and still are will be angry that some of what they thought they were getting has been renegotiated. But the people who rejoin will also find themselves not getting the deal that they think they would, because it won't be the same as what they had. And I think that, again, elections happen in primary colours. So I get why it's very easy to stick a "we will join the single market" in your manifesto. But I think there's a vast underestimation of the complexities of renegotiating any treaty with a trade bloc as big as Europe. And equally, I think there's a vast underestimation of the changes that are happening within the European Parliament and the effects that could have on what trading with Europe might mean. And I don't think, I wouldn't be entirely shocked if in a decade's time we didn't find that the liberal left of the UK had switched to wanting to stay out of the EU, and the right and hard right went the other way.
You're saying this because we're seeing more hard right and far right parties and politicians being elected in Europe.
I'm saying that partly because of that, but also because of the impact of that might have on what Europe does and how it organises itself. The reason that the left switched from being anti-EEC to pro-Europe in the late 80s was because of the changes that Jacques Delors made, and making it a much more social project rather than simply an economic capitalist club. If those changes are unpicked and undone by a newly right-wing European Parliament, then that makes it significantly less attractive for the liberal and the left to want to join it.
I mean, it's a fascinating point, and maybe it's a greater discussion for after the election. I'm actually not going to be as sophisticated as you. You'll be surprised to know. I think...
Never are, babe, never are.
Correct, yeah, I know entirely. Anyone who listens to the show on a regular basis knows that. But I actually don't think it is as sophisticated as the points you're making. That may be true after the election, but I think the reason no one wants to talk about it now is because the Conservative Party, led by Brexiteer Rishi Sunak, cannot say the thing I campaigned for has made some economic growth more difficult. The Labour Party, led by, let's be honest, very pro-EU Keir Starmer, can't say that because it causes all sorts of problems to try and attract Brexiteer voters in the red wall. A bit of a crude point, but you know what I'm getting at. And so it's, and the Lib Dems, well, look, they can, as you rightly say, they can put whatever they want on in their manifesto. They ain't going to be in a coalition government to make it a problem.
See, I think we're answering two different questions. You're talking about why people aren't talking about it.
Yes, I am, exactly.
And that's I think your analysis of that is absolutely right. So I don't think we're disagreeing on that.
Okay.
But I'm saying that it's not whether or not they talk about it, but what the future of the UK's relationship with Europe is. And I don't think they're not talking about the future of UK's relationship with Europe because of the things I'm raising. I'm saying they're not thinking yet about the things that I'm raising.
Which, yeah, I mean, you're probably right, and that's worrying in and of itself. But I'm struck by how this major thing that is still having major economic effects, when the economy is really a big part of what the election debate is, I'm still struck, you know, barely, you know, not very many interviews and debates are asking about it. The politicians aren't raising it by, you know, Rishi Sunak is barely going, I got us out the EU, look at the deal, I redid the Windsor framework. We're not even hearing that kind of stuff, really.
Well, I mean, the Windsor framework is just one small part of it, because he can't say I got us out. He has to say Boris Johnson got us out, and he doesn't want to mention Boris Johnson.
Right, which I think is another part of the dynamic and the question I'm answering, absolutely.
But again, I come back to the reason they're not doing this is because it's happened. It's like saying, you know, I don't know, the Great Reform Act, like, what do you think of that? Like, how do we respond to the Great Reform Act?
I mean, I don't think it is, though, because to some extent, I mean, what's strange, and I guess we know the answer to this, is the Conservatives are basically not trying to run on anything they've done over the last 14 years. We're hardly seeing, you know, it's all about a change, a plan, a bold action, not we've done this, this and this, don't give it up now. Perhaps if they were running,
the Conservatives are hardly running on their record, so they're not
exactly
mentioning it. I mean, yeah, all the reasons that you say that no one's talking about it are right, but equally, it is now part. I think for too many people on my side of the debate, Remain, Rejoin, what have you.
Sorry, out of interest, would you want to rejoin the EU?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would as well, although And I voted Remain very, very strongly. You know, I would vote Remain any day of the week. But I'm struck by your point of how difficult it would be to rejoin, and our terms would be far less good.
I would want to do it. And emotionally, in my heart, I completely want to still be part of the EU. I still consider myself a European.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just also aware of how complex it is and the fact that people aren't properly talking about that or considering it. And again, it comes back to that head versus heart. You know, there's a gut feeling that we should be part of the EU without going, okay, but what does that mean then? And transferring that heart to head. Yes, I would want to rejoin. Would I want to rejoin in a decade? Let's see what it looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I would rejoin that, as well.
But, I just come back to the fact that people aren't talking about it. And I was, you know, what I was halfway through saying before you asked me the reasonable question about whether I would or not, is that rejoiners have not yet accepted that Brexit is part of the furniture. And it is. I'm afraid it just is. And how we move from the lack of acceptance to the next space as people who would like to rejoin the EU is something that needs much, much more discussion and thinking about. But it ain't going to happen during an election campaign.
Yeah, I think you've pretty hit the nail on the head there. you and I can say, look, and I've had concerns about the democratic consequences of having a second referendum. If I'm honest, my thinking on that has bounced around quite a lot over the last 8 years.
Me too. Look, I was a huge, huge, I marched for a second referendum. Did I worked you? For Labour for Republic Vote. But I have since then had misgivings because I have listened to the way that Brexit voters felt that they were being treated over that. And I can't entirely disagree with them.
I actually went sort of have got to a similar place to you, but the other way round. I think I wrote a piece saying that, you know, us Remainers have to accept it now. And now I'm kind of think, you know, I'm much more inclined to have a second referendum now. It's very interesting. It's all a debate for after the election.
I think the other reason that we're not talking about it, and I think it's a real, real reason, mm-hmm. Is Labour's big offer is stability. Mm-hmm. And there is a meme in political journalism that says voters are much more, what's the word? I'm so menopausal.
Sophisticated?
Changeable.
Change, okay.
And volatile, that's the word that keeps being used, than they ever have been. Now, I'm not saying that's not true. I'm saying I don't think we know that yet. What happened in the 2010s was two highly divisive referendums in this country, plus a third one that no one cared about. There was the Scottish independence referendum, which was the first seriously divisive. And then there was Brexit. And both of those caused a certain amount of volatility. But that has been translated into voters are now permanently more volatile. And I just don't know that we know that yet. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just not saying that we've got enough distance from those things for us to believe that that is the permanent state rather than the reaction to those two referendums.
I actually don't think, I think voters really do want stability. I think people are exhausted from the two referendums.
Which is why nobody's going to give you a second vote right now.
Absolutely. I think they're exhausted by the referenda. I think they're exhausted by the political instability that Brexit caused. I think they're exhausted by the multiple general elections we've had and the multiple prime ministers and multiple scandals that have come with that they've had. I think they're exhausted by the pandemic. No one's talking about the toll that took on us, and that has an effect in political life. I really believe that. And so let's get actually, because this links to the last thing I want to talk about, because we haven't really touched on it, which is the we've had obviously this week all the manifestos come out of the, you yes. know, the major parties. Now, I don't think any of them have anything game changing, and then the kind of the Conservatives try and do everything at the wall.
Oh my God, yeah, like kitchen sink manifesto.
A bit of a kitchen sink manifesto. Labour, it's interesting. I saw someone make this point on Twitter, one of the journalists. Oh, it might have been our friend Tim again, actually. Making the point that if Labour hadn't trailed the policies that were in the manifesto,
it would be seen as so radical.
Do you agree with that?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. What I find fascinating about Labour's manifesto, so there are two points that I want to bring up here that I find interesting. One is about political communications point. It's a very, very, very narrative document. Whereas, I've read the Lib Dem manifesto, the Green manifesto, the Tory manifesto and the Labour manifesto, right?
Are you okay?
I might live. Things I do for my clients. I'm very, very good at my job. If you want a communications consultant and I ever have any capacity again, please hire me. but all of the others had bullet points of we will X, we will Y, we will Z. And Labour's wasn't like that at all. I mean, it had things that they would do, but they were all set out in a much broader, more narrative frame. They also were the only ones that had really clever website that had bits of video in between the sections.
Oh, nice.
Which I'd not seen before on that kind of document, but I thought worked really, really beautifully. And what is... So It is perfectly possible for different people with different approaches and opinions to project onto the Labour manifesto what they want to believe it's about. And frankly, what it is more than anything else is a permission document for potential quite transformational change to the way that we do government and economics in this country. That's not saying that's what's going to happen, but it is all there. The way that they have structured this manifesto is a story about changing the way that we do both of those things. And in the election, all of the questions are retail questions. So the reason that the noise since the Labour manifesto from people who feel the need to question Labour, which is a perfectly valid need, they should be questioned, has been so much focused on why haven't you got the two-child policy? And the Labour answer sounds quite woolly because it's like, well, we're going to transform and change everything. We're going to stop things at source rather than dealing with things at end. And that is not a retail politics. It's a really hard question to make on the doorstep. But if it happens, it will be the biggest change in the way that this country thinks of itself, is governed and managed since Thatcher.
So you're saying this is a big radical document. I love your explanation. I've just got also, I love your passion for these things, even if I don't agree with you.
I'm a think tank person. I love looking under the hood, but
do.
I also get that looking under the hood is quite a niche occupation and voters are not going to be doing that. If, and as I say, it is just an if at the moment, if this happens, first if it works, second if, what needs to then happen is for voters to understand the difference it's made to their lives.
Look, that's all true. I have the page up that you're talking about. It is really nicely presented as a piece of work. I would quite like to... Yeah, there's Rachel Reeves in a very nice coat walking around on a video. Yeah, it's a very nice piece of work. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with much of it, but that's not really the point.
No, because you're a mad right winger and you want the smallest state as possible.
Terrible right winger. Yes, obviously. But it is fascinating. I don't really want to do the crude kind of do manifestos make a difference kind of conversation. Because I think it's a bit cynical.
I don't think they do make a difference.
You don't?
Very often. I think that they will confirm your priors a lot of the time. Mm. And that's what I mean by people can see this manifesto. So the Tory press have gone, oh, this is all the things that Labour don't mention. And this means that we're in for a socialist superstate. I wish. The Labour left have looked at it and gone, this is just Thatcherism, really, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, the Labour left have had a complete meltdown.
Yeah.
I mean, throughout the campaign. It's almost like, Emma, they don't like to win.
Well, yes, quite. Well, winning means governing, and governing means choosing and doing the hard yards. Mm. And it's so much more fun to shout from the outside.
It certainly seems so. Look, it's going to be fascinating. Obviously, the importance, you know, we can talk about, oh, it looks pretty online. Oh, it's got XYZ in it. It doesn't have XYZ in it. We do have to remember the importance of manifestos, particularly the Labour one, given that they're going to be the government.
Yeah, I think they're important. I just don't think they change campaigns. There's a difference.
What they do change is, for example, the House of Lords will not block stuff that's in a manifesto, for example.
Which is why I find this Labour's narrative manifesto fascinating, because as I say, I think it's a permission document to do things that we're not really, that because all the journalists are asking retail politics questions, aren't getting under the hood of, but it's all there in the manifesto.
Mm. I have to say, and I might write something on this, and I suspect you and I can discuss it, but perhaps after the campaign. I am quite exhausted by the quality of the coverage. I think it's not serving anyone that well in lots of cases. I mean, I think...
No, there's such a Jeremy Paxman light, light, light approach. So
all about gotcha question.
Gotcha question.
Yeah.
And I just don't find it, like, maybe in the 90s it was illuminating when we had three channels and you could get Michael Howard to not answer a question 14 times. We've come so far since then in terms of communications. And it just... So I was listening to, I think it was Politics at Jack and Sam, and they were talking about how brilliantly Beth Ridby had done at getting the news moment. And I was thinking, yeah... And that's for a really small audience of political journalists. But I'm not sure it works for the audience of voters.
No, I mean, and I, as I say, I have a whole
And
thing.
That's not to say I don't think Beth Rigby's a good journalist. I do. I thought she did very well.
Yeah.
But it's not the same thing. And I think journalists are really far too insular in understanding that.
Oh, guilty as charged. And I think it's a particular problem with Westminster and the lobby system. As I say, I really want to explore this perhaps after the election. Obviously, look, the Conservatives, for me, the manifesto was their last chance to try and shift anything. And given that we spent the first part of the show talking about reform overtaking them in the polls, well, maybe it has changed anything, but not how they wanted.
Well, indeed. I mean, the last big moments have kind of happened. There will be some gaffes from all sides over the next 3 weeks. Ed Davey will find himself going downhill in a tin bath at some point. Keir Starmer will say something stumbly. Rishi Sunak will, I don't know, shoot a dog. I mean, he's done veterans, so the next thing in terms of British sentiment has to be animals, right?
Yeah, sort of feels like it.
But I think this downwards so slope period, I can't remember if I told you this on our paid only Patreon.
Yes, we'll come
episode on Tuesday, but I spoke to a pollster and said, when do the polls tend to narrow? And he says, if they don't narrow this week, they probably won't.
Interesting. Let's talk. There's one other thing, actually, I want to talk about. I want to talk about Sir Keir Starmer's Jeremy Corbyn moment, because it really irritated me, as you might imagine, when he talked about the Conservative manifesto and called it, it was like a Jeremy Corbyn manifesto. That is a manifesto you campaigned on. That is a man you tried to get into Downing Street twice. It was smug. It was pathetic. It really, really annoyed me. And you can shake your head at as much as you want, but it really annoyed me. It's totally... And I thought, actually, I'll tell you what I really thought. I thought it was a little bit of a trolling moment because he wanted to get that, this reaction. And frankly, it's pathetic. You know, Wes Streeting can make that point, because Wes Streeting and Rachel Reeves never sat on Jeremy Corbyn's front bench. He did for years. And you don't get to...
Of course he did, because he wanted to be leader of the Labour Party. You know who's leader of the Labour Party? Not Wes Streeting, not Rachel Reeves. Keir Starmer did what he had to do, and I'm fine with that.
Okay, you're fine with that. I'm really not. I think it shows...
I think, again, you're in the weedsiness is showing. Come off it. You know what collective responsibility is. The Lib Dems stood on a manifesto about tuition fees, fucked it over, and they've answered for that. Keir Starmer stood with Jeremy Corbyn, had to have an answer for that, and his answer is, I now reject that. That's fine. That's politics, babe.
I don't think it is fine, actually. I think it shows the worst bits that people associate with Keir Starmer, and I really didn't like it.
I know you didn't, but then you're slightly more anti-Corbyn than the public sentiment as a whole.
Oh, for
sure. The public sentiment's pretty anti-Corbyn. So your gut response is not the same gut response as a voter in Macclesfield.
Almost certainly not, but that's not really the point I'm making. I thought it was a really poor moment. I thought it was a bit smug, because I think it was...
It was unnecessary.
Exactly.
But... I'm really just not willing to get exercised about it.
No, of course you're not, because you want a Labour government. But
it's not just because I want a Labour government, but it's because I think it's not exercisable.
I disagree.
I know, but you're in a very small minority.
Oh, I'm sure, but that doesn't mean I'm wrong. And it doesn't mean I'm not entitled to... Well, it doesn't. It doesn't mean I'm not entitled
I mean,
to
you're
the
wrong
opinion.
in terms of you're absolutely entitled to your opinion, but I think if you think this means anything bigger than it does, then I think you're wrong.
Oh, no, I don't think it's going to mean any difference. I think he's sweeping into Downing Street, but I think it showed all the things that people have criticised him for over the years, you know, since he's been the leader, the sort of flip-floppiness, the sliminess, the smugness, the fact
sliminess. Come on, Charlotte, that's excessive.
No, I don't think so.
I flip-floppiness is fine. Smugness, that's a personal takeaway that people can have or not have. I think calling politicians slimy is really excessive.
Okay.
I mean, unless they're like on the fringes, I think I don't think that's the way. I wouldn't even say that about Rishi Sunak.
Oh, well, I thought it was a really poor moment. It's that I think it's the first time the mask has slipped in this campaign. And
again, it's not a mask. That mask has slipped phrase. I fucking hate that phrase, as if he's pretending to be somebody else completely. And he's not. That's like, look, I called Nigel Farage a huckster earlier.
You did.
Because I think that's what he is. I don't think Keir Starmer is pretending to be something other than he is, but I think that that the primary colours of trying to paint him as one thing or the other is harder to do.
Fair enough, but I just thought it was a really poor moment. I think your point that it was unnecessary.
I think the fact that we've talked about it for 10 minutes now is unnecessary.
Well, it's been about three. But I think your point that what he said was unnecessary is completely right. And I think that is a large part of why I resented it, because it was a bit of a trolling moment as well. It's a bit like setting out a tweet that, you know, is going to wind up people. And I know you don't think we're meant to criticise Labour at all because it's all going perfectly well. But
that's not what I'm saying, Charlotte. And that's deeply ridiculous. Sorry. No, I'm not having that. I have been critical of Labour throughout this campaign. That you think that I'm disagreeing with you because of being partisan is deeply insulting, frankly, and I'm not having it.
But I thought it was a really poor moment. I thought...
You can think that all you like, but if you think I'm defending it because I'm being partisan rather than honest, then I'm not having that. I'm not having it.
Okay. We'll be interested to see if he keeps getting asked about it in the last couple of weeks. The reaction to it was kind of interesting. As you say, it was a moment that passed. But anyway, that was one of my takeaways from this week as well. We've got a lot more to go, haven't we? As you say, the big moments have kind of passed.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot more time to go. I'm not sure we've got a lot more content to go.
Right, this is the final point I wanted to make, actually, because I'm actually pretty done with this. I know that's terrible to say, given the show we run. We know the outcome within a margin of a few, you know, some seats here or there. We know he's going to be the next Prime Minister. We know he's going to be the next government.
Can't we just get on with it?
I've sort of got to that point. I don't think it's not like a close one where anything could change, you know, dramatically, I don't think. No. You could have some terrible dramatic moment that moves things, but I don't think so.
I mean, I think, yeah, I it's like the manifestos are out. People now have documents to vote on. They've met the candidates in several TV debates. Keir Starmer's doing his one-on-one with Nick Robinson tonight, which I won't see because I'm at theatre, but I'll try to watch afterwards. I just don't think that anything is going to shift the dial. So what are the next 3 weeks for, other than torturing the Tories and possibly extending their pensions ever so slightly?
Never mind torturing the Tories. Is, you know, torturing the public.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because usually it's the last 3 weeks where the public tune in, but this feels like such a long campaign. It's not actually that much longer than it would be normally. You need 25 working days, which is 5 weeks. We've got a 6-week campaign. You know, legally, it has to be 25 working days. But I think because of social media, rolling news, all of the things... Podcasts. Oh my God. Even I, who am a complete podcast addict, am struggling to keep up with all the podcasts.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
I just think that we are looking, it feels longer than it has before. And I think, again, that may be because of the foregone conclusion. Like, I think in 2019,
And also,
technically was a foregone conclusion, but because of 2017, there was always that element of, oh, will it, won't it?
yeah.
2017 was a fascinating and exciting election for all of the reasons that we could go into, because it genuinely was a surprising election. This one just isn't.
No.
And, no alarms and no surprises. I guess that's the Labour campaign song.
And we've also known it's been coming for a while. People have been in campaign mode for a while. It's all a bit exhausting. Anyway, we're going to make it through to the end. I hope we're bringing some light in the dark and some signal in the noise for all of you. As Emma mentioned before, if you want to get even more from us, because you can't ever have too many political podcasts, really, head over to
Well, certainly
patreon.com/.
not ones that are actually good and led by two women.
Well, quite. Head over to patreon.com/houseofcommentspodcast. We do slightly shorter special episodes for our paid subscribers there. It's a mere fiver a month. You get my newsletter for that and Emma's paid newsletter for that as well. So it's basically we're ripping ourselves off. Head over to patreon.com/houseofcommentspodcast for all of that. Where else can people keep up with you, Emma?
I mean, mostly it's the newsletter and occasionally, well, not occasionally, but more than I'd like, but less than I used to on Twitter. And I'm still calling it bloody Twitter. Sod off, Elon Musk.
That's hard thinking on the soft left is your newsletter.
The hard thing on the soft left is the newsletter. My Twitter is Emma Burnell underscore. Do not go to Emma Burnell because she's a Leeds United fan that talks about football a lot, and you'll be either disappointed or pleasantly surprised by her content.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across social media. Head over to theaddition.net for my blogs, podcast, and access to my newsletter as well. We're halfway there, and we'll see you next week.